Welcome to today's digital lunchbox. We're going to be discussing making the right decisions for your website redesign. So what to do, what not to do. And I'm joined by several of our 08 experts, Seth, Tyler, and Adam, to talk about just that. So first question is, what are some major design mistakes in your experience that you've seen with website redesigns?
Sure, I can start with a few. You know, one thing is an unclear or just completely lack of value proposition. So who are you? What do you do? Why should I care? And how are you different? That really should be front and center on your homepage, but then also any other important page, you know, helping the user understand what's there and why they should care and, you know, what it's all about. Another thing is too much text, really long, large paragraphs that aren't broken up either in bullet points or various other ways of distributing text on a web page, whether that's in card format or there are a bunch of ways. And then, you know, in turn, not enough white space or visual hierarchy, right? So different headings, different visual boxes or ways of breaking up information so that a user can easily scan the page, see what's important, see those headings, and parse it really quickly, especially in this day and age on different mobile devices as our attention decreases. That's really important.
Yeah, I think for me, just all those things become really vital when we think about the purpose of the website. The purpose of the website for most folks in B2B is, you know, to garner more leads and get engagement for your content. And if you have 17 different calls to action and the hierarchy is all wonky, you know, the website is going to be, it's not going to be serving your business well. And so, yeah, Seth, I agree totally. All those things are super important to make sure that the website is serving its function for your business. And is converting well. Without those, you know, what's the point?
Another thing I add there is that, you know, image assets or good assets for a website are fantastic, but if they're used and then nothing is used with them, a lot of times it can be basically more of a deterrent. So making sure that when you're designing out a website, use those pretty images you have, but make sure that there is an actual call to action associated with it. Instead of just making that take up most of the page and there's no text associated with it at all. It's a fine line between having a good image asset and also having a solid user journey.
So I feel like we come across this a few times at 08. We always want to guide clients in the best direction, but sometimes they just like to have certain things on their website. So is there anything that should never appear on your website, even if at first thought you really, really want it just because it looks cool?
Well, you know, my big beef tends to be auto-rotating sliders, which are prone to a concept called banner blindness, where people see them as ads, don't visually parse them, and even the first slide, your mileage really varies, but it looks like Justin joined as well. Maybe he has some ideas.
Hello.
Hi. Justin's our.
Yeah, anything that I feel like anything that would that is outside of the user's control, that you kind of, when the user doesn't expect something to happen, like an auto rotating slider, can be a deterrent for users because. Well, they have their own goals and you're kind of forcing things upon them, and that can be a deterrent.
Yeah, we just saw this in action this morning on one of our internal company calls where we share what we've been up to, and one of our sales team members was recently on a vacation with his girls, and he was showing us the loft that they were in, but the loft's website had an auto-rotating thing, so he couldn't like show the image. It was a great image. To Adam's earlier point, it was serving a clear purpose. There was great text aligned with it. But because it was outside of the user's control, like Justin's saying here, it became almost like a hindrance to using the site well. You know, you want to see that, you want to read the text, interact with it. And there was just no way to control it. So yeah, poor Corey was just struggling with that.
So what about usability mistakes, aside from the design?
So one thing is using design patterns that nobody has ever seen. You could have a really creative rotating something or other, and it's just so creative, but no one knows what that is or how to use it. Yeah, that's one thing that we see. And then in turn, with some of those things or other things, not taking into account the different experiences and screen sizes of mobile, you know, which is very scroll heavy, flick flick, different attention spans. Those are some of the things.
What else? Yeah, a great example of that. Oh, sorry, Adam, go ahead.
I was going to mention navigation as well. Prioritizing the nav bar and knowing what you want users to get to. If you kind of load up your nav bar with a lot of stuff that isn't highly prioritized by the user, but you feel like you need to put it up there, people could get distracted by that as well. Go ahead, Tyler.
Yeah, so to Seth's earlier point, mobile, user experience, we ran into quite a few cases with this where several of our clients have had these interactive map features. And on mobile, a lot of times maps can create what's called a scroll island, where you get to it and you get stuck in it and then you can't scroll out of it unless it can be a real big pain for users. And so one of the things that we did with each of those was installing separate JavaScript that, you know, kind of made that become like a clickable element first. And then you could interact with the map instead of, you know, being stuck in the scroll island automatically. So those are all different things where, where you've got to take into consideration how the user is actually going to use the website, where they're going to be using it. And in those cases, we couldn't avoid using a map. It was vital to the site's functionality. So how do you address that usability issue on mobile in a creative way?
Adam, you brought up navigation. What are some more do's and don'ts with navigation?
Well, I mean, the big one is if you do have, you know, sub nav items, how deep are you going in there? How much is it nested? Are you going from about us to donate to something else? Is it in the nav bar by the end of you moving through it? Is it going down halfway down the screen? Now, if that's happening, then maybe you need to reprioritize that nav bar and figure out what actually matters. You don't have to have every single thing in the nav bar itself, but instead think about what are people going to be doing when they actually get to the page they're clicking on in that nav item. Maybe you could provide a path to that donate page in a different way that won't be so confusing to someone. Another important thing is if you have a really big site, utilizing breadcrumbs when it's necessary is good as well. Sometimes it might not be completely necessary if you have a really tiny site, but for these bigger ones, making sure that the user knows exactly where they are in the site and how to get back to that home page or that About Us page that they want to check in on again now that they have a better idea of what the organization is all about can be super important.
Generally, we avoid using two different navigation patterns on the same page. So meaning you'll have your primary navigation usually across the top and then a secondary side panel, just because that can be, in most cases, really confusing for users. But there are some cases where that actually can be a really valid and very helpful addition to the page content. One thing that jumps to mind is a project that Justin is working on right now. We're wrapping up with a training website. Justin, could you speak just briefly to some of the challenges that training website faced with the complexity and the depth of that information architecture, and how you created a really elegant solution to having both that primary and the secondary navigation, along with some icons there too?
Sure. So it was mainly like a resource website where the challenge is that you have lots of different resources that are connected in different ways. And so the navigation needs to mimic how a user would best approach to get to those pieces of information. And then sometimes that's not always the same way. So by putting in like clues, like say like with icons or something like that, to tell to for a user to determine what kind of type of content, and say like if a piece of content has sub content that is a more intuitive way, I guess, like making it more intuitive for the user to get to point A to point, I don't know, Q or Z or somewhere down the branch line. So yeah, it was definitely a challenge, but I think things have like worked out really well. So
yeah, so that, you know, you can get a sense for just the complexity of that site and the content. Unless if you're facing a similar situation, don't use two different navigation patterns on the same page. It just yields a mess. It's going to kill your conversion rates. Don't do it.
So another thing that we always like to take into consideration here at OA is performance. So what are some problems we see there?
I think Adam touched on one of those earlier, and that was adding lots of big images that aren't really necessarily value add or tying back to clear calls to action, things like that. Adam, how have you dealt with, you know, obviously images are really important, like you said, when they're valid, when they're value add, when they have that call to action, how do you address just the sheer size of some of these widescreen, full screen images that we encounter?
Yep. Well, I mean, quality of images is important. And one of the most frustrating things is when you have this really great image or a really great asset, and all of a sudden it's slowing down your site a ton, which even one image, if not optimized right, can do that. Now, luckily, there are solutions outside of just basically saying, I guess I'm going to have to live with a super blurry image or something now. Instead, we usually recommend using a CDN. What a CDN will do is basically hold these images on a separate server and send them to a site separately from however you're hosting it. Basically, pairing this together with your website will allow you to actually host these images at really high quality while increasing site speed. I mean, there's so many other perks that we could jump into with CDNs outside of just providing good image quality and a faster website, such as security and whatnot, but that's usually the first step you want to take. If a CDN isn't an option, which at all, sometimes it isn't, although I think there are ways you can work around that usually, there are other things you can do, like making sure that as you upload images, content creators know basically how those can be compressed on the website itself. The CMSs we use, Drupal and WordPress, over the years are constantly thinking about how to make sure that they're optimizing images that are uploaded to the site. And there's a lot of really great plugins and modules, as well as just functionality within the sites itself that allow for those to be optimized correctly.
Justin, could you speak to some of the baked-in features of Drupal 8 and the underlying architecture there that address a lot of the common performance issues that we see?
So Drupal 8 is more complicated than Drupal 7, but it has a much more sophisticated cache system. So a lot of those things that weren't cached or were cached on like only like a page by page level are cached in Drupal 8. And so the caching mechanisms like within it really make speed things up despite the complexity that is underneath. So because of that, you can have complex caching chains, like say if you have like if you change like a piece of content rather than clearing the cache for the whole site just so that that piece of content updates everywhere, it can bubble up to just the areas that that need it, even like in a component within a page. So
yeah, this can be really helpful for e-commerce scenarios when you have products that are updating or changing frequently. just that little section on the page or the pages where it's relevant for that product listing can be cleared within the cache with Drupal instead of having to clear the entire page or the entire site like Justin's talking about.
I just wanted to say in terms of optimizing from the get-go too, when you're actually designing out a new web page, it really shouldn't always just be what's going to look good, you know, what's going to look pretty, but through the whole process, you have to be thinking about how heavy duty is this page going to be on the site? Do we have a ton of different functionality on the homepage here? And do all those have to call for different kind of portions of the website or have any different types of like Ajax calls, for instance? And when that happens, it's going to slow down the page. So you really do have to think about your design from a functionality standpoint from start to finish as well.
Yeah. And one other thing to think about, you know, Adam, to tie back into your earlier point on CDNs and images and the benefits there that we can realize, Google is continuing to shift more and more weight behind the page performance and your site performance for rankings within the SERPs, the search engine results pages. As we see this shift continuing to evolve, Google's taking into account new factors like server response times and things that really go beyond just optimizing the content on your page, but really rely very heavily on the infrastructure that that's used to serve that page to your site visitors. And that's where, again, a CDN can come in really handy, ensuring that there's a really quick response time initially, and that those assets are being chunked out and loaded from the nearest server across a global network as quickly as possible to really help reduce all of the lag time before even a visitor sees the first pieces of your website. So just a whole nother layer of complexity that Google's adding in there, but really from a user perspective and user experience perspective, that's really important.
So the last thing I want to touch on is legal issues, and this is becoming more and more important when it comes to web design. This is something many organizations forget to consider, but there's a lot of new legislation out there that makes you need to start thinking about it. So let's talk about that. What types of legal issues do we see, and what do you need to consider when building and designing a site?
I think one semi-recently that we had, and maybe Adam, you can talk a little bit more to this since you dealt directly with them, but there's the issue of content origination, where you get your content, making sure that you have the rights to that content, and that it's not duplicated across other sites. We had a client come to us kind of in panic mode saying that their site had been, maybe scraped or something. There was, some confusion there. So Adam, could you maybe speak a little bit to just the scenario that can happen with a business around copyright?
Yeah, sure. So it's more common than anybody would like for it to happen. But when you have a website, especially one that's really putting out a lot of content, there are other sites out there that could scrape that content and put it on theirs. They basically just have a bot kind of viewing either your RSS feed or other certain kind of access points to the site, and will just basically copy your blog word for word onto another one. Now, just because this happens, you should handle it right away, but it's not something to freak out and panic about. Usually these things can be handled pretty quickly. Just through a few steps, first contacting the content of the site and telling them, please take this content down. This is copyrighted. Like, this is not appropriate to be copying this over to your site. And usually people will follow suit with that. From there, usually there's a hosting provider that's hosting this person's website, and contacting them and discussing it with them is probably the next approach if the owner of that website is not responding to your messages. So really I'd recommend, taking it step by step, making sure not to freak out too much. This stuff does happen, and you usually have the best content on your site and a much better site than probably whoever's scraping your site will have. Usually they throw these sites up and they look very messy. it could be solved, but it's something really to keep an eye out for, because not only is that frustrating to have your content being stolen like that, but it will affect your SEO scores and just rankings on Google as well, because sometimes Google can't really tell what's actually the originator, or sees this as basically duplicate and not as highly prioritized content.
So Adam, what notifies you that your content has been duplicated or stolen?
That's not something. There aren't exactly notifications of this, but instead, and Tyler, if you have any tools, chime in. But it's really something that you'll just have to keep an eye out for. Tyler, do you know any tools or thoughts on actually kind of keeping, making sure that this isn't happening besides just monitoring Google?
Yeah, Google Webmaster Tools, if your site does get scraped and you're Google is identifying that as duplicate content and you receive a penalty, you'll get a notification through Google Webmaster Tools. But usually to get to that scenario, you've got to be in a pretty serious pickle. at which point I would definitely recommend contacting someone and not trying to handle it yourself. But there are other ways. So usually these scrapers, they'll take and copy the entire block of HTML on your site. And that'll usually include your Google Analytics tracking pixel and script, which then you can set up a report for in Google Analytics to look for websites that are reporting back data to your Google Analytics ID that aren't actually your websites. That can be a really great, very easy way to look for that. There are also some services out there that you can pay for that will crawl the internet and look for scraped content, but generally, unless if you're running like a content syndication site or something that you're really investing like seriously heavily into content generation, the cost of those services isn't going to outweigh the benefit to you. So really keeping an eye on Google Webmaster Tools and Google Analytics are going to be your cheapest and easiest ways to keep an eye on that.
Yeah, you know, sometimes when you see like a dip of traffic or a change in traffic that you don't expect, sometimes it can be associated with something like that. Maybe people are getting directed to the same piece of content on this other site, for instance. Just on that note on the Google Analytics, Tyler, just with stuff I've seen in the past, is it's the same with other stuff. Like we actually had a form be scraped and put on another site by accident, and we had discontinued a form and saw an entry come in front to it, but from a different website. Since it's pulling the entire script over, you'll see some odd behavior if there is a bot constantly scraping that. And you just have to make sure to keep your eyes open for that.
So in terms of other issues, go ahead, Tyler.
I was just going to say, on the flip side, so we've been talking about what to do if your site has been scraped or you are the victim of a copyright issue. But on the flip side, if, say, you've borrowed especially stock photos from somewhere and you get like a takedown notice or something, the simplest thing to do is comply with that, say you're really sorry, purchase the stock photo, and go about things the right way. The plain and simple answer to avoid issues like that is to just make sure that you're purchasing your stock photos, your videos, things like that from reputable sources. And if you're outsourcing your content writing, making sure that that also is coming from a reputable source. If it's dirt cheap, chances are it might be coming from a content farm, and you should definitely check that against some plagiarism tools and things like that to make sure that you're not getting regurgitated content from somewhere else that then goes on your site and you get in trouble for having, you know, copyrighted or plagiarized content, even though you paid for it, you know, legally. So just some other things to keep an eye out for. Sorry, Hadley.
No, you're fine. So with the 6 minutes we have left, I was hoping, I know this is a big broad topic, but in terms of other areas of compliance that we need to pay attention to, we've got ADA compliance, GDPR, CCPA, all of these things. So Tyler, if you can talk to us a little bit about how we take those into consideration and why it's important for businesses and organizations to do that, that would be great.
Yeah, so compliance is a really big and very complex topic, maybe something that we can talk about entirely like in its own dedicated segment. And the number of acronyms, especially around data privacy law right now, can become like alphabet soup really, really quickly if you try and dive into this. The bottom line is that data privacy especially is evolving literally on a week-by-week basis. And so it's going to be really important, especially if you're serving clients right now or gathering data from visitors in California, from Canada, or anywhere in the EU, that you're contacting someone, a third party, trusted third party vendor or agency who knows about these things and can help to ensure that your website and your digital platforms are in compliance and that your processes that support those are also in compliance. Compliance with these things often goes well beyond the tools and the websites that we use to gather that data. And there's back office processes that need to support those things as well. Speaking to ADA specifically, the Americans with Disabilities Act, there have been just a flurry of lawsuits coming to private businesses most recently that really a couple of landmark rulings have found that websites should be treated just like any other, public facility. Meaning, you have to install a handicap ramp at your brick and mortar business. Well, you have to make sure that your digital presence for your business is also accessible to people with disabilities. And that can really be very wide ranging. Justin, do you want to talk just a bit about some of the most common ADA issues and compliance things that we see and some of the things that we're doing to address those through our site builds?
Sure. So they can range from, having to use a screen reader, for instance, would be how your website looks to visually is very much different, of course, to like a screen reader. And so being able to make sure that when you're creating the code that it also makes sense with a screen reader. And there's lots of tools out there that you can do or just installing a screen reader yourself, which I've done to get a sense of what your website looks like auditorily. In addition to this, there are several other areas that you can concentrate on. For instance, color blindness is one that's very common, and especially in the red-green spectrum. And so certain colors on your site, like if you are pairing, red and green, can be a big issue, or even just contrasting of colors, having one color that is not very on top of another that doesn't produce a very good contrast can provide issues with folks with impairments that aren't able to see in those spectrums as well. So there's a number of things to be aware of, and there's just a lot of good practices that you can employ. So I hope that is a good general basis. Is there any others that you were thinking of, Tyler?
Yeah, color blindness is a huge one. Something like 3 million new cases of color blindness a year are diagnosed. It's a really common problem and can be really problematic, like Justin, you were saying, especially when calls to actions or buttons are using certain color combinations. You can't even read or tell that there's text there. Some other issues, very common again, are like me. I take my glasses off and I couldn't identify any one of your faces there. making sure that, especially for folks with low vision, not necessarily blindness, but low vision or impaired vision like that, that your site has adjustable text and is designed in a way that's really clear and legible. Things as simple as that fall under ADA, and ensuring that your site is truly accessible to all is not only the right thing to do, but also good for business and SEO. Oftentimes, ensuring that your site is structured properly and these things are addressed the Venn diagram of things that you do for accessibility and things that you do for SEO are, they overlap really, really heavily. So this can be an area where you can just get a lot of wins by just doing the right thing. So again, if you're wondering, like, is it worth the investment? It definitely is, not just from avoiding, you know, potential legal issues, but also from site speed, SEO, all that jazz.
Yeah.
Usually it's a fantastic way just through an ADA audit to see how you can simplify your site, you know, even outside of SEO, ADA, like, you will find a lot of bulk on your site that ADA compliance tells you to get rid of. And once you get rid of it, it will be so refreshing. You'll be so happy. And everybody will be able to go to your site, which is wonderful.
Right. And Tyler, you said one of our favorite things here at O8, just do the right thing. We like to push that with clients, not just from a moral standpoint, but also from a technical standpoint. We promise it'll save you time and money in the long run. Just get it right the first time. So if you have any questions on everything we covered, please just talk to us. We would love to hear from you, and we'll be back next Tuesday. Thanks, everyone.